Blog Talk Radio.
You're from the stream of life, connected to the ocean of the Most High, endless godliness awaiting you. Good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world, you're listening to Soul Class, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. We just heard from beautiful brother Isaac Patton from Songs for a Brother, which was made over 35, 36, maybe 37 years ago. And today's class, Soul Class 294, In Search of Ancient Authentic Torah. Blessed those, we hope to continue this series by vibing out on Genesis chapter 3, verse 17, as it says in the Torah, the Bible. And to man he said, quote, because you listened to your wife and you ate from the tree, from that I commanded you, saying, quote, you should not eat of it. Cursed be the ground for your sake. With toil shall you eat of it all the days of your life. Wow, to be cursed and to cause trouble for the earth, this is overwhelming. See from where I plucked from, blessed souls, from the Genesis Rabbah, quote, cursed will be the ground because of you, it will bring up cursed things for you like flies, fleas, plus ants. One who goes in the ways of evil, it is the nature of people to curse the breasts of his mother who suckled him or her. How can we react to this teaching concerning original man, blessed souls? How are we supposed to react? Well, pesticide manufacturers might be quite happy with this teaching. Well, what about the rest of us? As well, we hope to talk about the teachings of Rambam, concepts relating to Israelite prophecy, the Book of Daniel, Chabad Chassidus, in addition to whatever may ensue when human beings are all endowed with a divine image, jam out during our humble efforts, scheduled to go live right now from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, 10:30 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Meanwhile, may we all realize each morning, blessed souls are renewed to empower us to make this world universally sustainable. And by the way, you might ask, why is Don calling everyone a blessed soul? Because I believe with simple faith, blessed souls, that if you go to Genesis chapter 9, verse 1, you see that the Most High blessed Noah and his three sons upon their emergence from that ancient ark, that ancient cruise liner, over 4,100 years ago. Joining me this morning is friend, teacher, and student, and disseminator of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon Maimonides. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don. And no matter what we call ourselves, no matter where we're from, or what label is put on our foreheads, we are all children of God.
That's right. Now, Dennis, I wanted to explore with you, and hopefully anyone else who wants to listen in, and you can also call in if you're interested, and even if it means that we'll reduce the amount of content we wanted to share, because this show is also about dialoguing. Whoever wants to dialogue, we're hopefully going to be joined by Business League, or Booker T. Washington Business League President Karchel Gore, and perhaps Ron Williams this morning. And if not, we'll between Dennis and I and the rest of you. I just want to also mention, as a caveat, any opinions expressed by myself, Don Zusigubin, or Dennis Ryan are not representative of any organization. We are speaking as individual human beings. We are not the masters of what we are teaching, but rather we are students of the teachings we hope to share in the next hour and a half. And therefore, our aim is to encourage you, blessed souls, to explore on your own, do your own research, and come up with your own conclusions how it is best to serve the Almighty God. And we suggest with love and fear, if you're one of the children of Israel, via trying to fulfill these 613 commandments, and if you're of the children of Noah, these seven universal commandments, which are commanded also at Mount Sinai, and Moses was reminded to remind the nations of the world that they have a tradition that even predates ours, and no one yet has come up with any sort of authoritative opinion to say that you should engage in killing, you should engage in serving idols, you should engage in stealing, you should engage in adultery, you should engage in eating the limb of an animal still alive, you should engage in blasphemy against the Most High, and you should not make systems of justice in the world. Those who promote that usually are connected to regimes which have been toppled or will be toppled, because they will melt like butter in the skillet with the fire of the Mashiach, the Messiah, who will reveal that this is a universal redemption for the entire human family experience. Now, blessed souls, I'd like to start with something, a topic about getting up in the morning. We all enjoy it, and if we don't, there's going to be trouble. It could mean sickness or even worse than that, and I don't want to go into the negative to the greatest extreme if we don't get up. Last night I was watching a video from the Blessed Frankel Shul in Kesser-Crown Heights, Brooklyn, New York, and a Rabbi Grossbaum, who runs the Lubavitch Chabad activities, trying to meet the spiritual and, where possible, the emotional, intellectual, and even economic needs of the Jews and for the children of Noah up in Canada, in Ontario, that he came up with an idea, after being advised by the Rebbe, that in that particular Lubavitch movement in Siddiq movement in Ontario, that they should try to do things which would be officially recognized by government officials to elevate the status of their activities, as opposed to just being one particular group within the Jewish community, but rather something which whose teaching should have some form of edification for those who interact with them, even on the governmental levels. Especially the Rebbe was very prone to say that if a person has the tenacity, and I guess we have to say courage as well, to the exclusion of just a self-serving ego, that they should use their influence to promote goodness in the world. So Rabbi Grossbaum had came up with an idea on his own, without first consulting the Rebbe, that he would give a kiddush cup, a beautiful big kiddush cup, which is usually used by Jewish people around the world to usher in the Sabbath or the holidays. And he was contacted by the Rebbe's office after he had done that, and the Rebbe had given him an instruction, meaning you gave a Kiddush cup for the prime minister, who is not a Jewish person, he's one of the sons of Noah, and he said, he put an exclamation and a question mark in a written response to the fact that Rabbi Grossbaum had reported that he had given that. So the Rebbe had responded that what would be better is to give him a prayer book, an English prayer book, even of Jewish liturgy, even though the prime minister was not of the Jewish people, but there is what to glean from, what to learn from, agree or disagree, whatever you see in the liturgy. And also to speak to the prime minister about the importance of the following very small prayer, which I'm going to humbly share with all of you out there. And I think, without taking a vow, I'd like to mention this at the beginning of every show, because the Rebbe said this is something that hopefully all world citizenry, meaning all people who are part of the citizenship of the world to make it a better world, will want to think and contemplate about to jumpstart their day. And the prayer goes like this, very simple. I give thanks before you, living and everlasting King, that you have returned to me my soul with mercies. Referring to the Creator, great is your faith in me. Or great is your faith. I'm adding, great is your faith. Let me just read it simply, and then I'll add a little color to it, and then we'll ask Dennis to give his viewpoint on this. Again, when a person wakes up in the morning to jumpstart their morning, no matter who you are, as long as you're a human being, and that means you have a divine image, it is well advised, according to the opinion of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, for all people who want to participate in making it a better world, to acknowledge that I am thankful before you, living and everlasting King, that you have returned to me my soul in mercies. Great is your faith. Dennis, any comments, questions, or concerns about what we just talked about?
Yeah, well, the first thing is, you mentioned government and trying to include all people. However, humans have a problem with the truth. The truth is the only thing that withstands the test of time. No matter what happens, the truth will be. Now, the truth is, yes, we wake up in the morning. Every time we wake up in the morning, we have a new chance to do better than we did in our previous days. That means it's like a new awakening. You can be a better person by saying, I want to be a better person, and actually doing it. And when you wake up, you can feel like you're going to accomplish something that you haven't done before. So every time you open up your eyes and wake up in the morning, you have a chance to do better. Hopefully, it'll be associated with the truth.
Okay. And the idea, let me ask you this, in your studies of Rambam or within the realms of Christian faith, the idea of restoration of soul in the morning, is this a concept you've come across before, that in our state of slumber, we are, of course, we are physically recharged, but also there is a sense of renewal of the soul as upon our waking moments to empower us for the rest of the day. Have you come across this concept?
Yes. What happens is it's also a scientific concept, believe it or not, not just a religious one. And that is your body is restoring all the chemicals while you're sleeping so that you're replenishing all your energy. Well, at the same time, you have what we call REM sleep, R-E-M, that sometimes allows you to go deep into your mind and clear a lot of things that are stressing you out or bugging you in any way, shape, or form. So when you wake up in the morning, it's your best chance to say, I'm ready for the new day, and treat it like a gift. And that is that you're going to do better and follow in the footsteps of the Lord.
Amen. Beautiful. With that being said, blessed souls, that, you know, there are so many different scenarios that human beings are presented in as they are raised up in this world. And unfortunately, far too many of the citizens of this world want to make it a better world. Now, say if a person doesn't want to make it a better world, of course, they're still a citizen of this world. We're not going to say someone is not a citizen of this world of civilization. I talk about the entirety of human civilization in this generation. But unfortunately, many have been exposed because of economic factors, cultural factors, family matters, that they get off on the when their soul is delivered down here into their blessed baby body, that they, when the train stops for their arrival into this world, they get off on the wrong side of the tracks. And literally what I want to read for you right now, blessed souls, is literally a letter of hell, but a letter from hell written by someone by the name of Moshe, who in the title of this article says, "Who am I?" And he talks about how he is trying to get back on the other side of the tracks. And this is, I'm gleaning generously from the yesterday's L'chaim, which means to life. It's a weekly publication, which is created to empower individuals, Jewish and children of Noah, to try to, again, to rethink their lives and see what they can do to make it a better world. And this article will focus on the person who helped Moshe. His name is Rabbi Fishel Jacobs. He's also known as the Karate Rabbi. He started life in Vermont, or early years, formative years, and he's a friend of mine. I actually assisted him for a little over a year at the University of Tel Aviv to try to help Jews wander back into their heritage, as opposed to, unfortunately, sometimes on the, and it's a big problem in the Israeli colleges where they encourage young Israelis or Jews coming from abroad to wander away from their heritage and the lifestyle and the consciousness of Torah. But I'm now going to go right into this article. I call this a letter from hell, and how from hell this person is starting to realize that he can leave the hell that he was born into, or what he willingly or subconsciously brought himself into. Here we go. "It's a simple enough question, but until recently, I hadn't been able to answer it. Who are you? For years, I was proud of who I was. I had no worries in the world. I was making great money, living a life of fun, fancy, and fast cars, and thought that nothing or no one could touch me. For years, I was a professional criminal. And then my world came crashing down. I was caught. I was found guilty, and I am now in the process of serving a 12-year sentence in the Ramla prison in Israel." And blessed souls, the Ramla prison in Israel is not the Catskills, is not Tavern on the Green, it's hell. That's my own, you know, side commentary. "The day I entered the jail, I lost my identity. To the prison system, I was nearly a number. I had a name, but no one knew it, as I never used it. I only knew how to be a criminal. So behind bars, who was I? What defined me? I was a prisoner. When you are a prisoner, you have no definition. You have no status in the underworld and no status in the real world. You are nothing. Then I got a glimpse for the first time in my life into my faith. I met the prison rabbi. The other prisoners simply called them Jacobs. For the first time in my life, I began to learn the real answer. I am a Jew. I am a Jew who never really cared that he was a Jew. I am a Jew who was raised like most Israelis with the basic traditions, but with little care or understanding as to what of any of it meant. My parents were immigrants. What was passed down as our tradition was poverty, the illiteracy, and the hopelessness that many immigrants have experienced. And what got passed down was the need to survive and thrive at any cost. And that is exactly what I engaged in. I was a great criminal. I knew how to lie, I knew how to cheat, steal, and essentially get whatever I wanted, wherever I wanted it. I had no problems about my actions. I felt I was just helping to make the world a little more balanced. It wasn't my fault that I was raised with barely enough food to eat. I couldn't change what I was given, but I could change what I would get. And from a very young age, I learned what was profitable. Drugs and weapons were profitable. What I didn't realize was they were also deadly. Few believe this, but I think I really wanted to get caught. Call it pop psychology, but I think my getting caught was my cry for help. I knew something needed to change, but for the first time, I didn't know how to do it and make those changes. I only knew, and I knew it all too well, was how to do what was wrong. You see, getting caught and thrown in jail was a real blessing, and not even so much in disguise. I think it saved my life. But it was the prison chaplain who saved my soul. He introduced me to who I was and who I am and to who I want to be. Fishel, a.k.a. Jacobs, First of all, he ensured that the kitchen was kosher, so I could eat kosher food. There were mezuzahs put on the doors, and the rabbis did their jobs in the sublock yeshivas by giving classes in Torah throughout the week. At first, when I watched Jacob make his rounds, I thought that he knew what was good for him better than, and if he knew what was good for him, he better stay away from me. I was in a sublock with a lot of tough guys. Men would stab you in the blink of an eye if they needed to. Upon mentioning my thoughts to fellow inmates, I was informed that Jacobs was a black belt in karate, and if I was smart, I may want to stay away from him. And I can tell you, blessed souls, Fisher Jacobs knows his karate. I've seen him exhibit it, and he doesn't talk. But unfortunately, in the Ramah prison, or whatever prison system he visited, at times when push came to shove, he had to defend himself. It wasn't, again, it wasn't the Catskills, it wasn't Tavern on the Green. So continuing on with Moshe's story, I figured I would rely on the age-old idea that if you can't beat them, join them. He couldn't be that bad if other inmates liked him so much. The first time he came into my cell, I realized this meeting was going to be different. Here was someone who didn't care about my criminal past, wasn't impressed with my rap record, and only wanted to focus on what's inside me. No one had ever taken the time to ask or care about what was going on there. He did. He took one good look at me, and his eyes entered a place so deep within, a place I didn't know even existed. He was someone who embodied the exact opposite of everything I knew. I knew people who were nothing, but I pretended to be something. Fake it till you make it. That was what I lived by. Here was a Jew from America who wrote books and was successful in other ways, yet to him it meant nothing. All that mattered was helping others, and he told me that this is the aim of other Lubavitcher Hasidim who tried to be exactly like that. I mean, in the prototype Hasidic Lubavitch precision, it's about helping other people. Now, you know, working with prisoners is no easy task. Let's be honest here. We are the, and this is Moshe saying, and this is not my commentary, blessed souls, Moshe saying about himself, as prisoners, we are the garbage of the world, or at least that's how we're perceived. We are the people you hate, and rightly so. There's a reason why we are behind bars. We did something that landed us here. With few exceptions, we deserve to be where we are. So what kind of person with other career choices chooses to work with us? That was the first question I asked Jacobs when he entered my cell. His answer blew me away. He told me that the same question was asked to his Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, in regards to, as was known about him historically until he became ill, and how he didn't tire standing for hours handing out dollars to thousands upon thousands of people. The Rebbe answered that when you count diamonds, you don't get tired. Fishel added that even when those diamonds end up in a pile of mud, when you know that they're diamonds, you'll stick your hand in and pull them out. The mud may cover the diamond, but can't penetrate it or diminish its beauty and value. And the mud will wash off. I was a diamond, certainly covered in mud, a lot of mud. But I was still a diamond. Who would have thought that being in prison would be the greatest thing that ever happened to me? It wasn't until I came to prison that I learned who I was. Until then, I thought I knew, but I had no idea. Now, even with I'm still behind bars, I'm still in jail, I am finally free within. And though this is not a place where I want to stay, I'm using every minute of my time here as an opportunity for growth, an opportunity for repentance, an opportunity for change. I have begun to view my sentence as a yeshiva for ex-criminals. I have a lot of time to study Torah and try to attend a class in Jewish law every day. I keep the Sabbath now, I eat kosher food, and I try to do as many commandments as I can. Funny enough, because I was so well known on the streets, other inmates are willing to attend classes and learn because of me. Go figure. I wait for the day of my release. I await the day when I can give back to society and try and make up for the damage I did. I yearn for the day when I can marry a wonderful woman and bring beautiful children into this world. When I do leave these prison walls, I will know what to answer when I'm asked who I am. I am Moshe. I am a diamond. I am a Jew. Now, blessed soul, this is not just about a Jewish person. This is a story about a human being who started off on the wrong side or got off on the wrong side of the tracks upon being delivered into this world as he eventually moved into a life of crime and violence and drugs. And now he wants to reshape his life because someone looked at him and said, you're more than just the mud that you've covered yourself in or society has dumped upon you. Dennis, I took a long time to read this, but I thought this is something about the whole idea of renewal. And helping people, how can we help people, you know, realize that you know, there's a way out of a prison they might have been born into, or they might have entered in on their own conscious will, or even via their subconscious will.
Well, it was nice hearing a story from a child of God, and I wish him well.
Amen.
Most humans put themselves in boxes, and a box is more of a psychological thing, that you're stuck in a rut and you can't get out. Well, God has given you a mind, and you should be able to figure it out as a way to release yourself from this self-impression or oppression that you put on yourself, because mm-hmm. you are the answer. With God's help, you can go forth. And which this reminds me of a man, it's an extreme example, similar to the one that you just described on, and that is in the 3rd century. We had a man who committed every sin underneath the sun. Underneath the sun, that is, the earth. He committed every sin. I don't want to go into all the sins because that's teaching bad or evil. But anyway, after all this time that he spent committing every sin, he found God. How? I don't know. But he found God, and he became a very holy man. And he did write a book in the 3rd century called Confessions. But this is an extreme example. Do you have to commit every sin to find the right way towards God? No, you don't. You must start off. Every day gives you another chance to take a step in the right direction. Every day gives you a chance to shrug off what you don't think is the right thing that you've done in the days before. You have a chance to renew your outlook, your thinking, and your mind as to what direction you want to go into.
Beautiful, Dan. Thank you. Listen, I did not hear clearly the name of the book. Can you repeat the name of the book again, please?
Confessions.
Confessions, okay.
He confessed to everything that he did wrong.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. That's a brave soul. Speaking of brave...
Detail is in a book. I mean, you read it from a letter. This guy wrote a book. Oh.
Wow, wow, wow. May that story and the one I shared about Moshe, which I'm sure is an alias name, be a source of empowerment for those who are listening in or will hear eventually the archive version. Dennis, speaking of a brave soul, we have to mention Maimonides Rambam, because we know he was a brave soul. He was someone who survived the onslaught of the raid of what was it, the Alamedi, was it Alamadi extremists into Moorish Spain. Almohades, right? And he also lost his brother. He also fell in what we would probably call today a clinical depression, being bedridden for a year, and arose up from the prison of his own, his sufferings, to become one of the most well-known educators, spiritual guides, and all-around totally dedicated people. You know, a Renaissance man, even before the Renaissance period kicked in. Rambam. So, Dennis, what? Any comments on that? And then please share with us a teaching from Rambam.
All right. What the Rambam had was persistence and fortitude. He did not let those little bumps in life interfere what he thought was his reason for being on the planet. He did not let ugly people who tried to behead him or put him in jail. He did not let friends of his who renounced him to look good with the authorities and other things like that. He did not let people out of the Babylon area to influence his thinking as to how he explains the way to God. He just kept on going. I mean, he even wrote letters to the people in Yemen saying, don't believe in any falsehoods. Believe in what you know and trust in the name of the Lord. And he worked out these things. Everybody can work them out. Just like when you wake up and you want to say, let's begin anew. If you really make up your mind, you can do it. So here we have the Guide to the Perplexed, for the Perplexed, page 391. And here is the Moses Maimonides talking about man's perfection. So let me begin reading. Mm-hmm. The prophets have likewise explained unto us these things and have expressed the same opinion on them as the philosophers. They say distinctly that perfection in property, in health, or in character is not a perfection worthy to be sought as a cause of pride and glory for us, that the knowledge of God, true wisdom, is the only perfection which we should seek, in which we should glorify ourselves. Jeremiah, referring to these four kinds of perfection, says, "Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches, but let him that glorieth glory in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me." That is Jeremiah 9:22-23.
Mm-hmm.
See how the prophet arranged them according to their estimation in the eyes of the multitude? The rich man occupies the first rank, next is the mighty man, and then the wise man. That is the man of good moral principles. For in the eyes of the multitude, who are addressed in these words, he is likewise a great man. Thus is the reason why these three classes are enumerated in this order. Our sages have likewise derived from this passage the above-mentioned lessons and stated the same theory that has been explained in this chapter, that the simple term komaha, as a rule, denotes the highest aim of man, the knowledge of God, that these properties which man acquires makes his particular treasure and considers it as his perfection, in reality do not include any perfection, and that the religious acts prescribed in the law, the various kinds of worship and moral principles, which benefit all people in their social intercourse with each other, do not constitute the ultimate aim of man, nor can they be compared to it, for they are but preparations leading to it. Hear the opinion of our sages on the subject in their own words. The passage occurs in the Bereshit Rabbah and runs thus. In one place, Scripture says, "And all things that are desirable are not to be compared to her." In another place, "All things that thou desirest are not to be compared to unto her." That is Proverbs 8:11. By things that are desirable, the performance of divine precepts and good deeds is to be understood, whilst things that thou desirest refer to precious stones and pearls. Both things that are desirable and things that thou desirest cannot be compared to wisdom, but in this let him that glorieth glory, that he understandeth and knoweth me. Consider how concise this saying is, and how perfect its author, how nothing here is omitted of all that we have put forth after lengthy explanations and preliminary marks.
Well, Dennis, that is quite profound, and it's kind of hard to go beyond the teaching that you just shared with us, especially when there's really nothing to be added to it. It's just something like a full course. Excuse me, please. Dennis, can you hear me?
You were just breaking up. Now I can hear you clearly, Don.
Can you hear me now?
Just
Dennis?
Now, yes.
Okay, what happened was, as you were talking, my son has a folding bike. I was trying to help him, and the phone collapsed and the batteries fell out. So can you just give me, please, if you can continue to comment.
Don, that's just another child of God.
What's that?
Your son. He's a child of God.
Amen. So, Dennis, just give me 1 minute or 30 seconds. I'm just going to get his bike going, and if you can just fill in the empty space as I try to help him, okay?
No just kidding. Continue. Sure. Okay. I'll just continue here with Rambo. So, continuing with his words is, having stated the sublime ideas contained in that scriptural passage, and quoted the explanation of our sages, we will now complete what the remainder of the passage teaches us. The prophet does not content himself with explaining that the knowledge of God is the highest perfect, is the highest kind of perfection, for if this only had been his intention, he would have said, but in this let him who glorieth glory, that he understandeth and knoweth me, and would have stopped there. Or he would have said, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am one, or that I have not any likeness, that there is none like me, or a similar phrase. He says, however, that the man can only glory in the knowledge of God and the knowledge of his ways and attributes, which are his actions, as we have shown in expounding the passage. Show me now the ways. Exodus 38:13. We are thus told that this passage, that the divine acts, which ought to be known and ought to serve us as a guide in our actions, are hest, loving kindness, mishpeth, judgment, and zikadat, righteous. Another very important lesson is taught by the additional phrase, in the earth. It implies a fundamental principle of law. It rejects the theory of those who boldly assert, that God's providence does not extend below the sphere of the moon, and that the earth is abandoned, that the Lord has forsaken the earth, Ezekiel 8-12. It teaches and has been taught by the greatest of all wise men in the words, the earth is the Lord's, Exodus 9-29.
Beautiful, Dennis. Thank you for filling in there. This is the type of teaching where I humbly suggest those who've heard it that you can listen to the archive version and review it. You can also purchase Guide to the Perplexed and see for yourselves with your own blessed eyeballs and your own cerebral cognitive faculties and decide if you want to learn more. So this is why we want to share this type of material. Now, I'd like to share a teaching concerning the viewpoints of Rambam, from which I've been plucking from generously. I really enjoy this book, The Teachings of Maimonides, published by Aaronson Books by Jacob S. Minkin. And how last week we talked about how Rambam tried and for the most part succeeded, although from that time and onward still some people want to promote a deceptive, illusionary fantasy to see filled form of what universal redemption is. And Rambam was saying in his effort, what we talked about last week, is that where Rambam was dealing with concepts of redemption or even the resurrection of those who currently sleep in the dust, it is for the sake of the ultimate upliftment and improvement of human beings living in a world which will be quite natural. Not fantasy world, not Disney world, not whatever you want to say, Lunar Park. It's not the type of place where has been unfortunately portrayed, for better or worse, by the Hollywood and even by artists trying to perceive something that they really haven't done enough research on or even meditated upon or even prayed to God to be shown what is that we are talking about when we talk about the ultimate, if we want to talk in a psychological level, the top of the pyramid of human experience, which we hopefully will witness speedily in our days. So, going now, you know, plucking generalists from this book now, The Teachings of Maimonides, Commentator and Philosopher, Rambam was very concerned about revising the folklorish conception, or I'd like to add misconception, of the Messiah and Mashiach, and the Messianic age by maintaining that a teacher from Babylon, Bavel, Shmuel, Samuel, taught in the 3rd century that the difference in the Messianic age is not the difference that we might have thought of, but rather except that the nation of Israel will throw off the yoke of the nations that are currently have put their yoke around our necks for the last 1800, 1900 plus years, and we will gain, now this term might throw people off, it's political independence. I think a better word is our sovereignty. I want to be very clear that I don't feel we've become politically independent just because we have a modern state of Israel. And excuse me. Unfortunately, to our great pain, that many of the laws and the cultural norms within the Israeli modern society of the past 65 years are antithetical to the Messianic age, and therefore, as the Lubavitch Rebbe spoke, probably the more one occasion, but one occasion that I learned about, is that he viewed the state of Israel as something that should be integrated within a Torah viewpoint, and it's been a bitter struggle. But the political independence or sovereignty the Rambam is talking about was to the extent of, don't think that the political independence or sovereignty of Israel and the land of Israel will be filled with mystical speculations concerning Messiah, not concerning his origin or activity and marvelous superhuman powers ascribed to him. No, Messiah will not be walking around with a big blue cape that has an M embroidered on the back of the cape. Rambam, in fact, insisted that he must be regarded as a mortal human being, differing from his fellow men only in the fact that he is greater. He will be greater in the sense of what he will be able to accomplish, not intrinsically greater because he has a bigger bicep. He will be wiser and more glorious in his efforts to bring human beings together. He must be a descendant of the house of David, and like him, occupy himself with the study of Torah and observance of his commandments. Although he must restore the dynasty of King David and Solomon and affect the sovereignty of the Jews, so they may devote themselves to, this is interesting how Rambam, according to Minkin, brings out, they may devote themselves to the study of Torah and the sciences. And there need not be extraordinary changes in the world in the general way the world is run. And in human life, these are things to be expected of him. For then, as always, there will be rich and poor, strong and weak, wise and simple. The ready-made garments and baked bread produced by the earth, which the rabbis promised as incidental to the coming of the Messiah, is denoting only the case in which men will acquire the necessity of life when freed from the hardships of life. Being mortal, the Messiah himself will ultimately die and be succeeded by his descendants, in whose hands the Messianic dynasty will remain forever. After his comprehension exposition, which we talked a little bit about last week, about Olam Haba, the world to come, and the problems of life after death connected with it, Maimonides proceeded to the much contested formulations of the beliefs and teachings of Judaic teachings incumbent upon a Jew to accept if he were to have a share in the world to come. Now, at the time Rambam proposed all these things, he was only at the tender age of 33 years old. In an attempt to masaken, to fix the principles of Jewish faith, which were neither in the Bible nor in the Talmud, was there the least warrant for it. The nearest approach to the denial of future bliss is actually in the Mishnah, in the Talmudic tractate, the 10th page, side 1, where the following are enumerated. That there seems to be a great judgment here that, quote, he who denies the resurrection of the dead, he who says that the Torah, both the written and oral Torah, are not divinely revealed, and the Epicurean who does not believe in the moral government of the world, but the Mishnah does not categorically cut off one from the Jewish community for denying these principles, as would Maimonides, for refusing to accept his system of belief. So there's a lot of flexibility here. And, you know, one of the things we want to talk about as well, but we'll segue to Dennis in a moment, is that, you know, when very black and white issues are stated in the Torah, the Bible, or in the prophets, even at the level where everything seems black and white, before judgment is rendered upon that person on the human level, those people rendering the judgment better have an acute awareness of what transpired before the action, which was negative, what happened, were there people that witnessed it, and what are the consequences of the action. And this is something which will tie in later to the end part of the show when we talk about when the Most High laid down the law, so to speak, for Adam and for all of us, for all times, until the coming of the Messiah. So Dennis, I think I put a lot on the plate for discussion. I'm sure you have what to say about what I just read.
Well, I'd like to compress it a bit, Don, and that is, can you love God? if you love God, are there any worldly rewards that are greater than loving God? Now, to me personally, when the Messiah comes, goes, whatever, or the earth is renewed or is destroyed, whatever, the greatest gift that humans can get is spiritual happiness. And that comes in the form of love. If your heart is filled with love and your mind thinks along those terms, can there be a greater gift than that? I don't know. But those who experience it will understand the difference of the rewards on the human level or on the supernatural God's level.
Beautiful, Dennis. And you know, what you're saying reminds me, and I should hopefully be blessed, never forget this. If you love God, if you feel God's love in your life, aside from verbally testifying to it and sharing with people your experiences, I hope and pray, and I speak of myself before anyone else, I hope and pray that as I express my love for God and I feel His love in my life, that I can express it by showing love and hopefully compassion and getting a better understanding of the people that I interact with, whether it be in my personal environment, where I live with my own family, thank God, or where I work, or when I just walk out in the streets. And I think it's a process of just, you know, let's get it together. And so we're going to segue now by a song called Let's Get It Together by Blessed Son of Noah, Joshua Shirk, who lives up in Binghamton, New York. I hope you're listening, Josh. If not, you hear the archive version. But I love this song. We've played it before, and we're probably going to play it in the future, love, because I think the theme of Let's Get It Together is about if you love God and God loves you and you're aware of it, let's get it together and love other human beings. Here we go. This is Josh Shirk. It's about 2 minutes and 59 seconds. Enjoy, everyone.
Fear not, for you are here. We are dear. He is near. Just glow, because you know your heart is so. Some thoughts are better than others. All of us are sisters and brothers. Let's get it together. He's here. This is ours. Every hour is a flower. Fret not. I can tell that you fell. Can I help? Some thoughts are better than others. All of us are sisters and brothers. Let's get it together. Gaze long, lilacs bloom under the moon in our tune. Slow down, drift a while, half a mile for a smile. Some thoughts are better than others. All of us are sisters and brothers. Let's get it together. Move up, hemisphere. One is here. Let go of the pain. Once again, in the rain. Some thoughts are better than others. All of us are sisters and brothers. Let's get it together.
And that was Let's Get It Together by Joshua Shirk. Speaking about getting it together, we have one more person getting together with us right now. We have Booker T. Washington, Business League President Cartrell Gore. Good morning, Cartrell.
Booker T. Marine.
Okay.
Good morning,
Yeah, Cartrell, we have Dennis on the line. Of course, myself, Ron Williams, has so far been unable to connect with us. We have another 40 minutes to go. Cartrell, one of the subjects we talked about is that, you know, some people are born into this world, and for whatever reasons that are the secrets of the Most High, they get off on the wrong side of the track and get into trouble. Yet we learn from a story of a Jew living in an Israeli prison that there is a way out, and when there's assistance from others. And one of the things I wanted to bring up with Dennis, we'll share it with you now quickly. I just discovered him over last week. I was listening to an interview with him with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Radio. It's on WBAI, 99.5 FM. And he was talking about in 1944, he was in Budapest, Hungary, and the Nazis had invaded. And he as a little baby, he was very stressed out. And his father was sent to a work camp. And his mother called the doctor. He said, "Doctor, what can I do? My son's always crying. What do I do?" So the doctor said, "I'll tell you, ma'am, I don't know what to tell you, but I do know this. The Jewish babies in Budapest, when I see them, they're all crying. It's a problem." So Dr. Matei mentioned that later on in life, he became diagnosed with ADD. And his medical perspective, I think he's a medical doctor. I don't think he's a psychiatrist. That environmental circumstances, not so much genetics, he's more for environment over, you know, the genetics, that there's a formation or a dysfunctionality which can be programmed into the human mind because of lack of love, or there could be the economic stress of parents in raising the child, or what experiences in the environment, especially in the first 18 months. And he talked about there is a way to get out of it because the brain has a plasticity, it has a flexibility. We've all encountered problems in the world. We've all and we're not here to point a blame at someone because we don't have things right in our life. But what I want to ask you, Cartrell, you know, you're involved in helping children who are having trouble getting to school, attending on a regular basis. Yeah. Kids are falling through the, you know, what can we do to encourage parents of such children or parents as themselves break out of the idea that, well, it's a genetic thing, it's a cultural thing, because the mind is actually a receptacle for gaining freedom if it accesses certain information. And you're a man who's gained much information in your life. Can you comment on this, and then we'll turn to Dennis for his feedback?
I think it's a sociological thing. I have decided next week I'm going to a convention of attendance teachers or truant officers, and I was going to talk about bullying, among other things. And one of the things I'm going to talk about is there seems to be not only the problem of bullying has turned into the problem of youth suicide. Mm. I believe just this week, a girl who's 12 and a girl who's 15 committed suicide because they were bullying, and bullying has gone into cyberspace as cyberbullying and slander. And there are new laws in New York State to prevent this, and there are old-fashioned laws of slander and defamation of character. If your character is defamed on Facebook, you don't have to just take it, you know. You don't have to just take it, you know. But that is some of the things that we have. That is one of the new problems, youth suicide. That's... Well, I'm going to be doing some research on this next week before I speak on it next week.
Right. But I'd like to amplify that. I mean, it might seem a little tangential. And again, Dennis, please, I'm going to ask you to join the conversation. I took a training this past week by an organization. Unfortunately, I think it's Urban for Community. I think Urban Community Services, something like that. And they brought out some startling statistics that now in the United States of America, one out of five people, adults, walking around the streets freely as you and I, and we give them the right to walk freely around, are suffering from some form of mental illness or depression, diagnosed or undiagnosed. Now, I take yearly trainings, or sometimes every several months trainings, about the status of what's going on in the mental health system and what's going on with people in this country. And it used to be 1 in 8, and it went down to 1 in 7. So I remember in the last 6 years, we've gone from 1 to 8 and 1 to 5. And as well, I heard as well from there is unfortunately a very high rate of suicide now, not just for being cyberspace bullied, but among men 50 years and older, to the point where the statistics cited was that there are more men over 50 committing suicide, and it's primarily in the Caucasian human beings, that there is a greater rate of suicide among the Caucasian human beings than people dying from car accidents now in America. And there's also a wave of suicide in Europe, in Italy, and Spain, when people are being dispossessed from their homes. So what I'm trying to bring out, and I'll throw the ball to you, Dennis, it's a heavy ball. It's heavier than any medicine ball, I think, is that, again, we can all be locked in circumstances beyond our control, but yet the mind has this power when blessed from God, and hopefully we become aware of the blessings, to work our way out of the most difficult of circumstances. I mean, people survived slavery in this country. The American Indians, there's still plenty of them, have survived the onslaught they faced. The Jews and the Christians faced oppression and death and being stripped of all dignity in communist Russia. And, of course, 12 million people perished in the Holocaust, not just Jews, but children of Noah. How can we encourage people to realize there's a way out of even the most insane scenarios if we seek knowledge and hopefully to be blessed by God to use that knowledge towards a better purpose of making it a more stable world? Dennis.
All right, Don. In my opinion, we're still talking about love. The absence of love is suicide. If you have nothing to love, then why do you need life? Love is something that you cannot exhibit or show unless you feel it. If you don't feel it, you can't use it. So therefore, the old adage of know thyself still prevails. You must know what you have. Do you have love that you practice and it can grow and spread? Or are you just an island all by yourself that becomes helpless and there is nothing to live for? Now, the other part of this discussion is internal, external, outside, inside. What affects men? Humans on the earth, all humans, are affected by what, their genes or their environment? History has shown us that we argue about this ad nauseum. That is, that somebody says, oh, it's the environment that does it. Other people said, no, it's just the genes. Well, I got news for most people. You have to deal with it. Both of them affect us whether we like it or not, which comes back to the old adage again. Know thyself. Know who you are and how you're going to fit in. But you must have some love in your heart, or else you have no hope.
True. I mean, if I'm just going, I'm going to recapitulate in a way that, from what I understand from Dr. Gabor Mate, who's based, by the way, if anyone wants to reach out to him, he does have a website, and Gabor Mate is spelled G-A-B-O-R-M-A-T-E, Dr. Gabor, G-A-B-O-R, Mate, M-A-T-E, and he talked about the idea of attachment and development, meaning attachment is associated with love. When you love someone, whether it be Almighty God or someone else, you become attached to them, and that leads to development of something. Now, would it be a positive development or negative development? Well, that's according to your trial and error experience upon this earth. Cartrell, attachment and development, what do you have to say about that in terms of your observations of human beings and also dealing with these troubled children in our school system?
Attachment and development?
Yeah. I mean, if a person is given love or shows love, they're more likely to develop as human beings and be able to wear to weather the storms of the unexpected issues of life that can overwhelm anyone, any one of us at any one point in time.
It reminds me of a man who was convicted of murder, and the judge told him that his actions destroyed a family, and the convicted murderer said, "I never had a family."
Mm-hmm.
So he did not get the love. He was probably raised by social workers and the people who take care of orphanages and whatnot, and you know, the people come in and serve your food. It's just a job to them. You're not their family. They really don't.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
I grew up in an orphanage, believe it or not.
Okay.
And what happens, I believe, is those young people who don't realize all the bad things that are in the world because they were taught by their teachers and their parents all the good things.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody has to clue them in to how mean other people can be and how to recognize it. We normally forget about these things, and we think people are going to learn this on their own. Well, those poor, innocent souls, children of God again, who don't understand how other people can be mean, just don't get it because they think it's like the end of the world to them. So we must incorporate when we teach children what is good, but we also must keep them on the alert for what that can interfere with the good. And those appears that other people who have intentions of not following the same path you're following, but want to disrupt it. So we must teach them to have their guard up so that they can keep their important ideas in their heads and their hearts and not let other people affect them. I mean, that's what Rambam taught throughout his whole life, is that if you have the truth and you believe and you have the knowledge and you love God, let nothing deter you or get in your way.
Well, also that Rambam himself lost his mother at a very early age. He lost his brother at a more advanced age when he was in the adult stage. He did admit in his writings he went to a clinical depression, but he was able to overcome it. And certainly he was a lover of humanity. So certainly his faith combined with his knowledge and his step-by-step day-to-day living were the vessels by which he was able to accomplish to the point we still talk about his teachings. But Dennis, just for one moment, going back to your orphanage experiences, do you remember a seminal figure, aside from the theological teachings you got, that someone displayed love to you, that kind of, you know, ignited your self-love within yourself?
There were a couple of people along the way that basically said that you have to examine yourself and take inventory and decide what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
When I first heard that, I thought, well, that's something new. Why do I have to do that? I never saw it written down anywhere or no one instructed me. But these people were reminding me that you, yourself, you must maintain it, take care of it, and you must protect it, or else you're giving up. So why give up when you can do the right thing and follow the right path?
And for you, that instruction was an instruction that had love embedded within it?
No, it told me that other people cared,
uh-huh.
and they weren't looking for any reward or any value in it. They were just trying to be helpful. So we have people who feel like they can help other people without any reward for them or any good things in their favor. They just feel committed to help other people. And
well,
if you're
well,
lucky and you find some of those people, you will benefit.
But am I being radical then, Dennis, to suggest that if someone expressed care for you by giving you those type of instructions, which was certainly, to this day you live by them, wouldn't that be an expression of love?
It
caring
is
loving?
It is, but at that time, most people, especially if you're in an orphanage, you become sort of defensive, saying, what is this person's angle? What are they aiming for? What do they want from me? What do they want of me? So it's hard to accept a free gift without seeing any strings attached to it, because life is not easy, and life is not completely free. So you have to reason it and reason it about it and think about it, and then the resolution will occur. So it may happen a couple of years after these people gave you the instruction of how to be, of how they would consider to be helpful to you. So it isn't a question that it presses a button, a light goes on. It takes a little while, and that's what you meant when you started talking about development before. We all develop our thoughts. We must also develop our feelings. They go together.
True. Cartrell, caring and loving. Do you recall seminal moments in your youth or as a teenager where someone showed care, which I'm going to take the radical view? I don't know. My viewpoint that this is an expression of love, or was it love that met, that open love that was shown to you by family or friends, relatives, whatever, that then manifested as steps of caring towards your welfare?
Well, I was loved by a mother, a father, an aunt, an uncle, a grandmother, a grandfather, and a great-grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was my experience. Yeah, my great-grandmother didn't pass away until I was about 12. So
uh-huh.
Not many people get to know their great-grandmothers. Not many people get to know them, but I knew mine until age 12.
Mm-hmm.
And she was very good to me.
Do you feel out now? Go ahead. No, go ahead.
And they encouraged me, those, into my adulthood. In my youth in school, they encouraged me, and in adulthood in my career.
So perhaps, can we suggest...
Yes?
I'm sorry, Carson. Can we suggest that that vitamin L of love that you got from your parents and extended family helped you get through the trials and tribulations when at those times where you weren't successful, and perhaps... If you look back, that could be a very fundamental point of your success, that you were showered with love from your immediate family and extended family to lead you to where you've had a very successful care, a career where now you were involved in caring for others, even within the system of the New York City public school system. I'm just asking you if you can connect those dots. I don't know the answer. I'm asking you to fill in the blank.
Well, goodness gracious, my thoughts just got scrambled. But it's up to the family to provide love for a child. Now, if a child is raised without a family, that's going to be hard, because not many people who are paid to be at the orphanage are going to genuinely love you. I guess they must, though they cannot expect them to give love, I think they should be mandated to teach love. Maybe love amongst the fellow, among the friends that you have there. And some of the kids in the orphanage will not be your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
What Quattrell said is true. If you don't have a family to support you and show the love and develop the love, then you're dealing with sort of a blank part of your heart. And what happens is you have to find it in other ways. And the other ways come carefully and slowly. But the important thing is that you become more of yourself because of the absence of the family. So you have to realize that you have to do a lot more yourself because you don't have a supporting cast around you.
True. And I'm now that void in the heart that was just mentioned, it echoes within my mind. A Hasidic teaching about the idea of the capacity of a human being to receive new knowledge, new consciousness, and hopefully in order to not just empower him or herself, but for other human beings, the idea of a empty pit, which is devoid of any organism, snake, scorpion, even water. But so to speak, that void where a person is lacking humbles them. And one of the teachings in the oral Torah tradition of Torah is that if a person wants to humble themselves, They should go to a city where they're not known, because they don't have a support system, so they can, they, a person cannot, you know, romp around in arrogant fashion as if like he's taking over the town. You know, the natural forces that be, empowered by God, will put a person in their place unless they're planning to be the new Al Capone of that town, so to speak. So the capacity to deal with that emptiness or sense of void or sense of lacking, if a person has their spiritual cylinders, you know, running very precisely and efficiently, can be a source of being open up to new consciousness. When I took therapy, when I learned, and eventually I became a part-time instructor for a short period of time in therapeutic crisis intervention, that we, one of the things that was drummed over and over into our head is that the same Chinese symbol for crisis looks startlingly, astonishingly similar to the same Chinese symbol for opportunity. So with that being said, I'll let, if you do want to make a closing remark on this section of the show, then we're going to move on to talking about matters of prophecy. Karcho, anything else to embellish?
I've heard about those Chinese symbols, that crisis and opportunity, because in crisis you have the opportunity to succeed or get things accomplished. I'm told the symbol for Chinese for trouble is a horizontal line with two vertical lines, and mm-hmm. that symbolizes two wives under one roof. That's trouble, all right.
Don't want to go there, because my wife's
right.
in the next room.
Okay.
Dennis, anything you want to embellish on?
Yes, what happens is, because of the lack of family support, etc., you got to come up with your own reasoning, your own thinking, which is yourself. And the one thing that always stuck on me, that always worked, was that how do you get along with other people? And the one thing I found out over a period of time was you have to figure out what their motives are. If you can understand what motivates people, then you know how to deal with them and react. But at least by looking at their motive, you can decide very quickly, who are the good and who are the not so good. Because you're not going to be fooled, because you're looking for their motive. The smile on their face doesn't mean anything. If they hug you, it still doesn't mean anything. What is their motive is very important.
Beautiful. We're now going to move to the next to last section of our program. It's based on, again, plucking generously from a book put together by a young rabbi I think we'll be hearing from much more in the future, because he's very much inversed himself in teaching the 13 principles of faith by Rambam, Rabbi Chaim Miller. And in fact, he pulls generously from The Guide to Perplexed, and I'm going to read from that. The idea which clearly emerges from this description is that prophecy is an experience involving the intellect. We are taught of the merging of the human and divine intellect through which pure intellectual form is received. Now, we have to be very careful here in discussing these matters, blessed souls, because to become a prophet doesn't mean a person is generating his or her own prophetic intellect, as much as they have purified their body, they have purified their emotions, they have purified their intellectual perceptions or consciousness to become that loudspeaker, that transistor, that wireless connection, which we talked about in earlier shows, according to, I think, the Arizal, Rav Yitzhak Luria, the Seichel HaPoel, the active intellect, which is referring to a divine intellect, which is channeling down the various gradations into the creation to allow the human being, the prophet, to be the receptor of that consciousness. But there has to be an intellectual preparation for intellect of human to interact with intellect of the creator, which is dumbing down to our intellect. Now, again, in the Rambam, we talked about this last week, but I want to mention again, because I think this is something people, if they're interested in understanding the context, whenever they look into the five books of Moses, in every word, every verse, every chapter, every book of the five books, or the teachings of the Tanakh, the book of Judges, the book of Isaiah, the book of Samuel, that when you read those writings, it's predicated on this following foundation. When a person is full of all these qualities, which the person is wise, they're able to overcome their emotional tendencies, they don't follow the darkness of the masses, the lack of consciousness of the masses who follow the whatever is flying through the wind in that particular generation, and a person is bodily intact, and he enters the contemplative orchard to deliberate upon great and obscure matters, having a penetrating intellect to understand and grasp them, and his or her mind is constantly attuned heavenwardly, bound to the throne of glory, to comprehend the holy and pure forms, and he contemplates the wisdom of God from the first form to the center of the earth, from the greatest to the lowest manifestations in creation, and from this he knows God's greatness, and then immediately the prophetic spirit will rest upon him or her. And we see this is mentioned in the book of Samuel, book of Samuel, chapter 10, verse 6, where Samuel tells Saul, the future king Saul, the first king of Israel, quote, again in chapter 1, in the first book of Samuel, chapter 10, verse 6, quote, he will be transformed into a different man. He will understand that he no longer as he was before, and that he has surpassed the level of all other wise men. As written of Saul, you will prophesize with them and be transformed into a different person. So it's a transformational type of experience. And some prophets kept their ability to prophesy, some lost, some fell from grace, some ascended into greater grace. But the point is, Blessed, is that prophecy is not something that we can intellectually attain as much as we can intellectually prepare ourselves. And in my concluding remarks on this section, before we go to the book of Daniel, of course going to feedback for Dennis and Cartrell and Dennis, that Rambam's sixth principle, according to Rabbi Miller's assertions, is that we should try to understand the dynamic of prophecy, which is an interactive divine communication directly to the human mind. The prophet's mind is totally engaged with this revelation to the emerging of human and divine mind, and the level of prophecy will depend on the success of this merging. And prophecy is not merely an agent to transmit divine law Torah, rather it is significant in itself as an overt expression to give us further ample testimony God is within this world. Prophecy is also the actualization of the peak of human intellectual perfection. Paradoxically speaking, it's not of our own intellect, but rather testimony that we've purified our intellect. And also, he asserts that the foretelling of future events is not necessarily central to the function of the prophet, but rather an instruction that we should try to live with, not just live in a deterministic sense of, well, it's going to happen, might as well sit back on my couch and wait for the prophet to occur, and that the sixth principle, that there is the fact that the Most High communicates to us prophecy, is that divine revelation occurs within the human mind. So, Dennis, would you like to comment on these concepts?
Yes, and we have to be careful of the word intellect. We cannot use it for many different things. If you have a perfect intellect, you're probably sitting or standing in heaven right now. No human has a perfect intellect. And what happens is the prophecy is to help people to understand and to feel what they should feel. In other words, it's a way to live a better life. However, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have an increased intellect because you got a prophecy, because It could mean that you have an increased amount of love because you understand the prophecy. Mm-hmm. So how you benefit from the prophecy is what God intended. How it's done for each individual, I don't know. But we all can participate in it because it's like a freebie given from God. So therefore, the people who actually do the prophecy sometimes don't even get the benefit of it. But they do it anyway because they're transferring a message from the Almighty to humans.
True. Quattrell, any comments on these teachings?
Inspiring, but I have no comments.
Okay, so now we're going to look at one verse from the book of Daniel, as we've now integrated into our humble efforts here. Going back to chapter 1, verse 4, last week we talked, just mentions tersely, that it was the custom in the ancient kingdoms. Again, I don't know about today, or modern governments, I don't know what the custom is today, but back in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, which was, we're talking about 2,600-2,700 years ago, and this is also something that's placed in the ancient empire of Persia, that the king would hire eunuchs to take care of either the harems or in charge of those youths. Like, for instance, we're going to read in verse 4 of a captured people, and verse 4 from chapter 1 reads as follows: youths in whom there was no blemish, good-looking, skillful in all wisdom, discriminating in knowledge and perceptive in learning, and who had the stamina to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the script and language of the Chaldeans, the Chasdim. Now, we shouldn't think, blessed souls, that, you know, I'll just stop for one moment and say a teaching that I remember learning, and I hope I never forget it, is that talking about the problems we have today, even with Jewish contemporary Torah observant culture, one of my teachers, Rav Vichten, Olav Shalom, may he rest in peace, who was the former Rosh Hashiva of the Morristown Yeshiva, Teferes Bechurim, mentioned that the problems we have today, we inherited them. That doesn't mean we should accept the problems, but we should know that things that took place, that things that are still plaguing the human condition, are going back way, way back into time. And what I'm addressing now in this, at the beginning of this verse, when it talked about youth and who there was no blemish or good looking, so narcissism, modern narcissism, which many people are criticizing, I'm not a fan of narcissism, meaning the content or quality of a human being is not based on their bodily shape, but this is something that goes back way, 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 way back into time, that for whatever reason, and it, in the rabbinical commentaries I'm looking at, don't necessarily comment upon that. Why was it that the king, it was important in the court of Nebuchadnezzar not only to take from the children of Israel, from the royal seed, the nobles, but they should be good-looking youth with no blemish? I can only say this, is that this flies in the face of the, say, the teachings in Pirkei Avot, the Ephesus of the Fathers, where we're told, don't look what's on the outside of the container. There's a whole, you know, there's a whole discussion of where is Torah more best suited, in an older person or a younger person? Is it better to for a person to get Torah at a youth, which of course we, from a young age, of course we say it is, because let them be influenced by good stuff, as opposed to an old person who's like a piece of paper that's written on and on the paper is erased. But one of the sages said, don't look what's on the outside of the container. Look at that which was in the container. Meaning, regardless of a person's upbringing, it's about their inner content. But in the ancient kingdom, which was again the most powerful civilization at that time, for the years that Babylon ruled under the rulership of Nebuchadnezzar, it was something of, to the praise or the looking with awe and wonder at the kingship of Nebuchadnezzar, that there should be subdued the youth of the seed and the nobles of the nation of Israel. Now we can understand the following things that were expected of them: those who would be picked by the and raised and guided by the eunuchs. They should be skillful in all wisdom, called maskilim. And here we turn to Rambam, who talks about, I think Dennis mentioned this before, that chokhmah, skillful in all wisdom, is that this encompasses all pursuits of the mind. A person has an open, flexible, a very plastic, flexible type of mind, meaning intrinsically that is a strong mind. And where they're supposed to be discriminating in knowledge is that they have the ability to take upon, through their basic human intuition, to grow in higher mental consciousness until the point they can even reach Ruach HaKodesh, a Holy Spirit, or, as we just talked about before, even Nevuah. Now, was Nebuchadnezzar from the beginning looking to raise up a whole new group of prophets of Israel who had been subdued by the conquering of Jerusalem and the land of Israel, that he should use the prophets for his own devious means? I don't see it written here. That's something perhaps we can meditate upon. I don't know if we're going to get the answer. We probably won't get the answer until the coming of the Messiah, when I guess Nebuchadnezzar himself will resurrect and have to stand before the Messiah as all human beings to face the judgment. Also, the idea of there's a dexterity associated when a person can be discriminating in their minds and perceptive in learning, is that they are able to be take in systematic bodies of knowledge. Now, with that being said, they also, one of the requirements for the youth is that they had to have physical stamina to stand in the king's palace. I mean, they had to be people who were able to have the Rashi comments, one of the great commentators in the Talmudic and the Torah literature, saying that what Nebuchadnezzar was looking for was that these youth would be able to stand in the royal presence of King Nebuchadnezzar, and even just on the simplest level, to have control over their bodily functions while in the presence of the king, because people were supposed to stand in the presence of the king with such awe, they would almost be like statue-like. And I know from Jews that I know from Russia, who now live in America, told me that that in the times of Stalin, when he was the dictator in Russia, or the, so to speak, prime minister, or whatever you want to call him, as the leader of Russia, that if people were clapping after he made a speech, they were afraid to stop clapping, because there were instances when people stopped clapping in the presence of Stalin, because he did have a certain paranoia about him, which drove his own personal psyche, that if someone were to be seen first as the first person to stop clapping, they could be arrested and even given the death penalty. And at the end, of course, that these youth were to learn the law, the new language of their captors, the Chaldeans, of course, because this would be to the credit of Nebuchadnezzar, that he could take the best and the creme, so to speak, of the Israeli youth of the house of David, and I'll make them to show we can make citizens out of these people so they can be subdued to our service. I said a lot, but we're going to turn on to Dennis for any comments, questions, or concerns about these teachings.
Yes, you did say a lot, Don. You started off with eunuchs. That's a unique situation because, in effect, you're taking the sex drive away from the human. Does that mean the human is going to be better or worse? Who knows? Who can tell? If your left hand offends thee, should you cut it off? Will that make you a better person? It may or may not, but it should remind you that your left hand is gone. However, we are not judged on our physical presence. Are you a person that looks into the mirror? Or do you look at God? Well, if you try to look at God, you can't see him. It's only your faith and belief that will create an image as to what you're looking at. That is your mind and your heart. But the mirror is a human thing. If you place more importance on human things as opposed to non-human things, well, you have a long road to go in your life because you're going to be disappointed and not too happy.
Mm-hmm. Quattro, do you have anything to comment on these teachings?
I was just thinking about looking into infinity and looking into the mirror, and I was just thinking about what about looking onto physical limitation of inanimate objects that popped into my mind.
Okay. We're now gonna move into the very last section, which was basically, even though it's the last, we say that the last thing has a certain aspect which is cherished because it's the last thing to be discussed or presented in a certain scenario, in a certain environment. And we're going to quote now from Genesis chapter 3, verse 17. And again, let's read it. And to man he said, quote, because you listened to your wife and you ate from the tree that I commanded you, saying, quote, you shall not eat it. Cursed be the ground for your sake. With toil shall you eat of it all the days of your life. End of quote. End of verse. Now, there's a lot going on here. Now, remember, let's keep it in a certain context. Adam was a direct creation of the creator of all creation. He had no mother. He had no father to guide him. So to speak, the Almighty, in an allegorical sense, was the one who nurtured him from the moment that he was formed. And according to the oral Torah tradition, he was formed at the age of 20. It wasn't went from the time of his emerging from the earth, from just mere clay and having the breath of life infused into him, according to the divine will of the Creator. He was born as a prophet. There was nothing really to purify. It was before the first sin. He was And then Dennis mentioned something before about the idea of perfect. Now, just as allegorically speaking, when a person buys a new car, it's supposed to be, quote-unquote, in perfect condition. No scratches, no bumps, no lumps. Everything's working. So perfected is a state of completeness. Of course, the only thing that's truly perfect is the Creator. So Adam, in this pristine state, made a mistake, according to this verse, because he listened to his wife. And this should not be taken in any way, blessed souls, as last week we talked about, you know, Chava was chastised by the Almighty Creator because she coerced, so to speak, verbally, emotionally, intellectually, you might say, whatever you want to say, Adam to eat of the food he wasn't supposed to eat. Now, he said, because you listened to your wife. Now, right in that same verse, I told you not to eat from it. And we can look back, and not to criticize, but just to stand back in awe, to show, see that even a prophet, and Adam was a prophet, the first prophet, the father of all prophets, that the Most High still left within the capacity of the human experience, the beginning of all human experience in the most pristine of situations, to make a mistake that we are still working to try to understand and work out. The next implication from this verse, and this where it might become very difficult for many human beings to connect if they're unaware of this teaching according to the oral Torah tradition. Even if they become aware of it, they still might struggle with it, but we can understand it through a modern day scenario where we could better understand it, where it says in the verse, cursed shall be the soil for your sake. So the question is, what the heck, excuse my French, did the soil do? I mean, yeah, we came from the soil, so is that why it's cursed? Or is because of the action that Adam took that brought a negativity from his own personal experience as a human being and transferred that negativity into the earth that we see that Moses was commanded to recollect for us when the Most High chastised and said, now not, it didn't say you will be cursed, Adam, it said the earth will be cursed, meaning the negative behavior shall transfer a negativity into those things which are interacting with you, namely the soil. And it's mentioned here in the Oral Torah traditions that the Most High, again, according to Oral Torah traditions from people at Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, it was not the intent originally that the earth should produce harmful things like thorns, brambles, mosquitoes, and ants, but because Adam sinned, he did not deserve originally to suffer from these things, and as a result of that curse, there are many trees to this day that do not produce edible fruit. And if not for the sin, every tree will bear fruit. And there are prophecies from within the Oral Torah tradition that will talk about every tree eventually will produce fruit. And that's on a natural level, not on a mystical level. So the question is this, is there another reason why the earth was cursed? Well, from the Oral Torah traditions, that there is a reason. And this is connected to actually the angelic realm, because there is a teaching, if we understand angels as shluchi hashpa, transfers of bounty, that the Midrash teaches that for every blade of grass has its own angel, own means of getting its bounty from within the earth and from heaven, from the wind and the sun and the rain and the other nutrients in the soil, that there is a guidance of everything in this world by some particular form of angels. And there was some level, which I'm not going to go into it right now, but there was some level even prior to the sin of Adam that set up a precedent for the fact that the earth would now be cursed. It wouldn't be as fruitful as it is right now. But that's something, bless us, I'll invite you, and I'll challenge you to do your own research upon this to learn why was the earth cursed, I should say, because there was a certain disobeying based on the fact that the angels who are directing the bounty upon and into the earth did not carry out their their role as they should. And this should not surprise us, because in fact most of us understand that there was a rebellious angel in heaven called the Satan who rebelled against the Most High and entered the primordial snake, which caused a lot of trouble to this day. Again, I bit off a lot, I chewed a lot, and again, my intent is to inspire others, hopefully. That I hope that will be my blessing, to do more research into the matter. And now I'm going to turn to Dennis and Cartrell to add their comments, questions, or concerns. Dennis?
Well, I hope it doesn't bother your digestion, Don, because you ate so much there. Or chewed so much.
Slowly. I chewed it slowly.
Yes, okay. So let's put it this way, and let me capsulize some of this stuff without getting too deep into the psychological pros and cons and cons and pros. Adam represented all of humanity, no doubt about it. However, he did exercise one thing regarding the human condition. If you tell somebody, yes, this is what you should do, it's far easier to accept and understand as opposed to saying, you shouldn't do this and don't do that. Human curiosity immediately gets perked up and says, why shouldn't I do that? And what happens? We end up being drawn to the stuff that we shouldn't do because it wasn't explained that here's the good things and be wary of the other things. But human nature says, because I can't do it, is that a challenge? It's human nature. We are not perfect.
Beautiful. Cartrell, any questions, comments, concerns about these heavy matters?
I am surprised to hear you say that the fallen angel occupied the serpent. The Tanakh does not say that specifically.
Right.
That is a Christian tradition, by the way, but it's just not stated in the Book of Genesis.
Right. Well,
you say that.
Cartrell, that's why I said people might be surprised, but actually its root is in Jewish teachings from the Oral Torah, from the Kabbalah, the Hasidus, and we probably would find it in the Midrash as well, that the Satan, that angel, which by the way, in last week's Torah portion, we talked about in the prophet Zechariah, it talks about the impotence, ultimately, of the Satan, of the Satan, of the Yetzirah, the evil inclination before the Most High, and he was actually rebuked. So there is a reasoning in the Oral Torah tradition concerning the Satan, the evil urge, is that when he is separated from the other legions of God's angels, he goes out and makes the ruckus that we associate the more damaging aspects or the ultimate damaging aspects of the Satan, including separating the children of man from unity, and children of women, of course, all human beings. But when he's in the presence of other angels, he is nullified to the holiness, and he only do God's bidding. As there is a prophet that said, I think it's in Jeremiah, says that I created evil and I created good. The Most High, for whatever reason, again, within his wisdom and will, which is way beyond us, is testing us with this force, with evil, with our own inadequacies, and even with our good points, in order that we should still stay focused in the middle means that Rambam teaches us. So that's how I can only respond, that it's not in its root a Christian teaching, but it's something that the Christian scholars, who the original Christian teachers and students were Jews. So I think that that's something that transferred without acknowledging at whatever level, whether consciously or subconsciously, the fact that this is an authentic, pristine, Judaic, Mosaic teaching that the Satan got to Adam by injecting his spiritual venom into the snake, who injected his spiritual venom into Adam and Eve and brought mortality to the human condition.
Don?
Yes, Dennis.
I might add that Christian thinking emanated from Jewish thinking, and that the Christians started to change some of the thinking, but the basis was the same.
Yes. However, a lot of Christian thinking came from Greek thinking also.
Okay, I mean, maybe we can talk about the next show. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes,
go ahead.
There was a popular Hellenistic movement in the Promised Land, in the Holy Land, before and during the first century. It was a very popular Hellenistic movement, and that's where some of the Christianity diverged from Judaism.
Well, gentlemen, I'm on the one hand, I'm happy to say I really enjoyed this show. I'm a little sad that we're ending. Before we do, Cartel, would you like to remind our blessed soul audience out there about the fact that I'm assuming that you're still planning to make an appearance with Rabbi David Cohen at the UN. Do you want to remind everyone about that event?
Yes, it'll be June the 10th, a Monday. It'll start at 5 p.m. It should go until 9 p.m. My topic has changed, but it should be a very interesting evening. We'll be talking about the Noahide laws and whatnot, but it should be a very interesting evening and be open to the public.
Beautiful.
And at 777 United Nations Plaza.
Yeah. 777 United Nations Plaza. Beautiful. And also, I want to remind everyone that Cartel is the president of the Booker T. Washington Business League, an organization designed to empower human beings living in the New York City area, and hopefully as it grows in the environment outside of New York City. Cartel, is there a number that people can connect to you to learn more about the Booker T. Washington Business League?
You can call my 24-hour answering service, 718-670-3717. That's 718-670-3717.
Okay. And Dennis is our senior co-host here today. Would you like to make some concluding remarks before we end the show with a little music by our brother in arms, soul, spirit, and good cheer, David Dome?
Yeah. Love yourself, love everybody else, and especially love God.
Amen. With that being said, blessed souls, we're going to end off with a song by David Dome, who will help us get back home to remind us that we can get out and scrimmage by connecting to our divine image. Our Tzelem Elohim is no dream. Remember, blessed souls, if you are in this world, the world of good, yes, we're not going to deny, we're not going to be Pollyannish and say there's no evil. There's plenty of evil. However, the Almighty Creator put in this world to conquer evil on the most microcosmic level. It might be just saying a good word to someone, thinking, having a good thought right now about someone somewhere halfway around the world you never met, just saying someone, think about someone in Afghanistan who needs some encouragement, or Saudi Arabia, or Tel Aviv, or South Africa, or the North Pole, or Boise, Idaho, or Fresno, California, or NYC, especially we need some good thoughts for the New York Mets who are struggling, for you Met fans. But just remember, Ateva Tov Lehetiv, the Almighty is good who does good, and one of the good things he did was creating you. We're going to end off now in Pursuit of Happiness by David Dome, and hopefully next week we'll continue at this time, 10:30 a.m. to 12 p.m. We went a little bit over, that's okay. Live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA. Take care, everyone. And remember, think good, and it will be good, because the Most High is waiting for your next good thought to hope to show, to reveal to you. You can bring that good thought into positive action to make this world a better place. Totally consistent with a prophecy in Isaiah 45:18, the world was created to be a settled place. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.